We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, I'm very excited to be joined by the one and only Terry Schilling, president of the American Principles Project. Terry, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Emily. Excited to be here.
Terry, I rarely have people on to just talk about their organizations or their project or whatever it is, like do the PR thing. But in your case, I'm such a big fan of APP and what you've been doing there. I actually think you've really moved the needle on cultural issues and provided a model for Republicans and conservatives to talk about issues the establishment, Hollywood, media, everyone has told them, academia, they can't talk about, they can't push back on. And I feel like you've really provided a model for how to do that. You kind of call yourself the NRA for families. You just launched something called Big Families, which is very much, you know, intentionally a parallel to the way we talk about big oil, big pharma, all of those things. You have big families. And again, you're not just talking about it. You're not just sort of writing articles for The Federalist or anywhere else. You're actually putting money behind this messaging in swing states. And again, I think you've really moved the needle in a way that was necessary to show people how to do this stuff. So can you talk to us a little bit about how Big Families is an extension of this project?
Well, thank you for plugging us so hard, Emily. It's you've been a good friend to us, and I always appreciate someone that can actually summarize APP better than I can. I've been in DC for almost 10 years, and over that 10 years, I went from optimistic and hopeful to now cynical, right? Like, but I'm still hopeful in a brighter future. But we launched Big Family last year because we want to treat families as any other special interest group in this country is treated. Right? Like it's called Big Family because in DC, there's big pharma, big oil, big tobacco, big tech. There's all these bigs, but there was no big family. There was no one involved in public policy or campaigns and elections that was making the family the most important priority. And we're really cynical. And we know that politicians really only care about one thing, and that's their reelection. And so we wanted to use family politics, campaigns and elections based on family issues to change the culture. The thing that separates APP from everyone else in this town is we think that in a lot of ways, culture is actually downstream of politics. And to argue otherwise is to basically say that public policy and laws don't have an impact on your culture or your country. We all know that that's not true. And what we do is we show politicians how to win using family issues and to basically make their opponents pay a political price for being radical and anti-family, whether it's gender ideology, letting boys compete against girls in sports, teaching little kids about transgenderism or weird sex stuff in school, or even critical race theory, right, where we're teaching kids how to be racist. We basically use these pro-family issues to win campaigns and elections. And there's this weird thing when politicians figure out that an issue is going to help them win their reelection or hurt their reelection, it affects how they vote. It affects the things they prioritize. So that's basically the thing that separates APP from everyone else is we think that politics can actually help change the culture. America's unique in that regard. No other country's like that.
So Terry, the left would, of course, say the religious right has always pulled the strings of the Republican Party, that, you know, it was Jerry Falwell and Billy Graham that have always been in total control of the GOP. And I mean, from a movement conservative perspective, as I think both of us consider ourselves, that's laughable. Historically, that's laughable, despite the stereotype that might exist in media. So I guess my question for you is, how did we get here? How did the conservative movement get here? You know, you could go Irving Kristol, Barry Goldwater, Ronald Reagan, the Bush years. How are we at a point now where what you're doing feels so necessary, but also so new and fresh? Like, how did the Republican Party, how did the conservative movement get there?
Over the last, I would say, three decades, the Christian right or the pro-family movement started to withdraw from politics. James Dobson from Focus on the Family had a ton of political success. My mom and I were having a conversation about the transgender issue a few years ago. And she was like, she told me, she said, Terry, this trans issue was around, in the 1980s. But what happened is James Dobson use the issue on his radio show to, and inject it into politics and use it to kill those efforts. And what we've seen is essentially, so the IRS started coming after these pro-family political movements and their tax status. And so they'd form a C4. Well, then that C4 would come under scrutiny. And then you had this whole like lie that was adopted by the movement over time, which is that politics is downstream of culture. And if we really want to win in politics, we first have to win the hearts and minds of the American people. The problem with that argument is twofold. One, it's not true. Public policy and law and politics actually is a part of the culture, and it can do a lot to change the culture. As we've seen with the cultural left, they've done a lot to pass laws. All this transgender sports stuff, it's happening in areas where they've adopted transgender policies. It's not just happening out of nowhere. But the other thing that's wrong about it is that politics matters, right? I mean, and where the American people are is they're not progressives in a cultural sense. Progressives are always trying to push the boundaries. So you don't have to win the hearts and minds of the American people to convince them that boys can't become girls, right? That men can't have babies. They already know that. And by ceding the ground on these fights, it gives the left an opening to shut us down, to literally silence our speech, as we've been seeing with big tech. And so, you know, social conservatives have always had the hearts and minds of the American people at that point in time. But what happens is we don't fight on these issues, and we allow the left to make their arguments in the public square, and then we cede it and defer, right? You had John McCain in 2008, first time a presidential candidate had actually said that marriage is not a federal issue, that he was going to leave it to the states. That's odd, right? That is a weird thing. First of all, you don't want 50 different states defining marriage in a different way. Marriage and family is a universal thing that you want to be able to translate across state lines. But they didn't want to fight on it. I don't know what the issue was. Maybe they thought it was a losing issue. But in reality, wherever marriage has been on the ballot, it always outperformed the Republican at the top of the ticket. Marriage was on the ballot in 2012, for example, and it beat Romney in Maine and Maryland. Everywhere marriage has been on the ballot, it's always beat the Republican candidate. And 2008, right? Most notably, the state of California voted to protect marriage. They voted for Prop 8, led by a lot of Black voters, by the way. And they also voted for Barack Obama. This is the culture is always going to be more conservative than where the progressives want to take it.
Right. And the progressives don't understand that, nor does the sort of political establishment, progressives, media, academia, because they are in their they sort of have their own isolation from the rest of the country that tells them, you know, their ideas are really popular. They just have to continue sort of shoving it down everybody's throats and bulldozing public opinion. But that's this question of, you're actually the first person, Terry, who I heard on this podcast. It was happened on Federalist Radio Hour probably like a year and a half ago, push back on the famous Breitbart maxim that politics is downstream of culture. And I don't think Breitbart meant it in the sort of absolutist way that it gets used by some people, but you were the one who said, no. You know, you used the example of marriage. And I want to ask you to sort of flesh that out, because it is often so true and so important to remember that that culture is downstream of politics. So could you talk about marriage and specifically Obergefell in that context, how it shows that point?
So across the country, you know, there were very rare instances where the people had actually voted to affirm marriage voted to support gay marriage. It was primarily a courts driven thing. And what happened is the courts saw that Republican politicians were wavering, that they were moving away from defining marriage as between a man and a woman. And whenever the courts see that that politicians, or that an issue is getting out of politics and that politicians don't want to address it, they then take the issue up themselves. And that's exactly where you don't want these issues. So essentially, they took the sign that the Republican Party was cratering and caving in on gay marriage, and they thought it was time to enact gay marriage across the country. And so it's really important to keep these political fights alive. And you contrast where gay marriage is to the abortion fight, right? Very similar heartfelt issues that people feel very passionately about. But we aren't there on the pro-life issue. Why is that? It's because politicians haven't stopped fighting on it. And just to be clear, after the 2012 election, there was a real chance that that was going to happen. I don't know if you remember this, but the Republican Party released an autopsy where they sent of the 2012 election, basically saying why we lost. And what they said was social issues like abortion and marriage distracted from our winning economic message. We saw that report and we thought this can't go without rebuttal because two things are true. First of all, the social issues that they were complaining about actually are more popular than Republicans are, including on abortion. And the other thing that's true is that Republican economic message sucks. It's all centered around job creators, which basically translate to American voters as my boss and helping out them. And when you do, we in this report, we actually went in and figured out what percentage of Americans ever even start a small business. It's 5%. So when you build an economic message around job creators and entrepreneurs, you're literally coming up with an economic message that alienates 95% of Americans. And it's a total nightmare. We need to get back to, as a Republican Party, to talking about working families again. That should be the brunt. And that's not to say that we shouldn't be helping out businesses and alleviating their burdens. You're not going to have working families if you don't have a thriving business community, right? So it's not like one or the other, but when you're campaigning and you're running campaign ads and talking to 95% of voters who won't ever even start a business, you should probably focus on their concerns in the economy and not the concerns of Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg.
I actually keep a copy of the 2012 Republican autopsy on my desktop because I'm convinced it's going to vanish from the internet someday. It's just so amazing to look back on how every single prescription made by the smartest people in Republican politics, allegedly, that they put to paper was just absolutely blown up in a matter of years. I mean, like 4 years later, 3 years later, really, by the host of the Celebrity Apprentice. And Terry, now, if you had, you know, talked in the ways that you talk now in 2012, if you had been making these pitches at the time, and I'm sure you remember this, it's just like that's the kind of stuff that gets laughed out of town, basically. But now when you're doing it, I imagine you still encounter a good deal of skepticism. But I also wonder if you ever feel like you've liberated politicians and they can actually just sort of say sane things that they believe when it comes to like women's sports or whatever it is, as though like you're telling them, you know, it's okay to say what you believe on some of this.
Yeah. So where we're at now is completely different than where we were when we first started talking about this issue. On the sports issue, most, you know, notably, I would meet with donors and with politicians and tell them, hey, this women's sports issue is actually a key to winning your race. And just, you know, I know your audience is educated about this stuff, but we're talking about like the transgender sports issue where boys are saying that they're girls and then going in and destroying women in the competitions. And we would literally get laughed at. Like, you know, this isn't a problem. Like, what are you talking about? No one's talking about this. And now everyone's talking about it. I will say that, you know, what we're seeing in the states and at the federal level is very hopeful. You look at the two governors that vetoed the legislation, right? You have Spencer Cox in Utah and Eric Holcomb in Indiana. Spencer Cox had his veto overridden basically overnight, right? And these state legislators are basically saying like, you're crazy. We need to address this. Our voters are demanding it. I think that's where a lot of Republicans go wrong, right? If they just listen to the voters, most of the time they're going to choose the right thing. And, you know, I did an interview yesterday with a paper in Indiana about Eric Holcomb's veto and a poll we did that showed that literally 65% of Indianans, that's including Democrats and independents, 65% disagreed with his veto strongly, right? It wasn't just like, you know, lightly or somewhat, it was strongly disagree with his veto. And his response to the legislation in question was, this isn't a problem in Indiana. Like, that is such a terrible response, right? Like, for a lot of reasons. One, yeah, maybe it's not a problem in Indiana yet, but you're supposed to get ahead of problems. You're not supposed to let it happen and then address it. Like, why are you, like, we're such a backwards-looking party. You have to be forward-thinking and forward-looking. But then two, and this is even bigger, like, are you watching the news because a male just won the national women's championship in college? Like, literally the gold medal. Like, how can you actually argue with a straight face that this isn't an issue? Everyone's talking about it. 16 states have passed legislation on this, right? Like, you got to be a real jerk and a real, like, dishonest, corrupt politician to, with a straight face, say that, you know, this isn't an issue and that, you know, it's not a problem and that, you know, there's no reason to address it. Like, just say you want the Google board seat, right? Just say you want a seat on the Walmart board or the Disney board. Like, just be honest with people. Like, that's the thing that annoys me about politics is no one's honest.
Of course, many of our listeners are parents. So I want to let you guys know, parents, it is time to finally cross off one of the most important things on your to-do list, life insurance. Fabric makes getting a great term life insurance policy for your family quick, easy, and surprisingly affordable. Fabric was built specifically for parents to help you manage your family's financial future like a parenting pro, stress-free. Fabric's new lower prices mean significant savings over other providers with great policies like $1 million in coverage for less than $1 a day. Everything's also on your schedule with Fabric because it's all online. How convenient is that? Less than 10 minutes to apply and you could be offered coverage instantly with no health exam required. Then just personalize your quote to fit your family's needs and you'll be set with high quality, affordable protection for your family. What a weight off your shoulders. Fabric is fully backed by Vantas Life, one of the most trusted names in life insurance since 1847. So you can feel confident when you're getting a high quality policy that meets your family's needs. With Fabric's online hub, it's quick and easy to track your family finances all in one place. Get fast, affordable life insurance, create a will for your family, set up your kids' college savings plan, and even establish a rainy day savings fund. Planning for the future has never been easier. There's no risk to apply today either. Fabric has a 30-day money-back guarantee, and you can cancel at any time. So protect your family with term life insurance now in just 10 minutes. Apply today at meetfabric.com/Federalist. That's meetfabric.com/Federalist to start protecting your family today. M-E-E-T fabric.com/Federalist. Fabric Insurance Agency policies issued by Vantas Life. Not available in New York and Montana. Prices subject to underwriting and health.
What was the reasoning in, like, what specifically, with Kristi Noem, and she went back and did the right thing, I think because of the pressure campaign that you were really at the, I mean, that was the tip of the spear. You were really the sort of wind and the sails of that momentum to push Kristi Noem into a better direction. But we knew in that case, there were business interests at stake. What's going on in Indiana? What can you tell us about that case?
Well, I think it's just the, I think it's the same old stuff. I think it might be a little bit different. One thing that we don't, so basically these governors that hesitate to sign it, there's two reasons why they do it. One, they're either an LGBTQ ally and they've actually adopted transgender ideology as how they think. And I would say that that's Spencer Cox. The other is the business guy who is worried about economic boycotts of their state and economic pressures. The thing is the economic boycotts with Florida and Texas both passing legislation, they don't work anymore. Right, they took those two states on the table. So, in order to boycott a state like South Dakota or Indiana, these companies have to also boycott Florida and Texas, which they can't do because of the business environment and how much business they have to conduct in those states. And by the way, all of these corporations that talk about, you know, boycotting the states because they're not friendly to transgender people, they all do business in China, which doesn't allow gay people, doesn't allow transgender people. And by the way, they don't have free and fair elections. They don't even have elections there. So it's just, it's all just like these progressives, these woke artists have taken over these HR departments and these corporations, and they've all, you know, adopted ESG at their shareholder meetings. It's terrible, but there's nothing to fear. Like, they're not going to actually boycott their state. It's all just a ploy. It's an act.
A lot of conservatives sensed a shift after the leaked opinion, the leaked majority opinion from Justice Alito in the Dobbs case hit the news from the Politico report to see relative silence, or what they, I guess, interpreted as relative silence from corporate America, kind of post DeSantis and Disney in the case of the Dobbs leak. Were you surprised by, did you also sense a relative silence? Did you also sense a shift? Were you surprised by any of that at all?
Yeah, it's hard to argue that there hasn't been a huge shift after what Chris Rufo single-handedly did to, Chris Rufo and Ron DeSantis did to Disney. These corporations are getting the message, stay out of these culture wars. It's not good for business. It's not good for investment. It makes people question your dedication to your fiduciary duty to shareholders, right? Like we've never wanted corporations to get involved in these culture war battles. No one, Michael Jordan put it best in the 90s, both Republicans and Democrats buy shoes. I'm not gonna wade into who I'm voting for. And that should be the public policy position for corporations. And I would actually argue that the reason that these corporations went so woke and went so far down this rabbit hole is because there was no one on the other side making them pay a financial price to their woke extremism. It's, look, in all of these issues, it's better to be feared and loved, right? You want to be feared because someone that loves you will betray you and justify it and explain how much they really loved you, but they just couldn't go through with it, and they had the circumstances put them in a bad situation. And frankly, that was the hold that the Republican Party had with the Christian right and the family movement. Was the family movement was much more concerned about being loved than they were feared. And had they been more worried about being feared and holding the Republican Party accountable than just giving them lip service, no one can deny that the Republican Party gave a lot of great talking points and rhetoric and lip service to the family movement up until the 2010s. But we are getting back now, and this is really healthy, but we're getting back to being feared again because we're extracting a political price. We're extracting a financial price to wokeism. And it's beautiful.
I'm really curious to ask you, Terry, about the Barstool Conservatives Coalition. This is something that I wrote about recently. Came out of a conversation I was having actually with my friend Sagar and Jetty about Dave Portnoy saying, if abortion is the issue in the election, I vote Democrat. And I think there's something to be said for Portnoy as a representative example of maybe a secular, libertarian, go along and get along, pro-business type of voter that was so sickened by the excesses of radical progressivism seeping into the Democratic Party that they really liked the bold, no-nonsense politics of Donald Trump, who didn't sort of traffic in traditional political rhetoric and just called this BS like it is. And I'm wondering if you think that the coalition is as fragile as it seems to be in my perspective. And I might be wrong, but you know, this is a coalition of people that might be with Ron DeSantis so long as he's pushing back on this insane, excessive, radical progressivism in the school system or elsewhere down in Florida, but then will drop the Republican Party and actually shift to voting Democrat if pro-family issues, like genuine pro-family platform, is on the table. I guess I do see that as sort of a fragile coalition, but I'm curious as to what your take is on that, Terry.
No, I disagree with that. And the reason I disagree with that is because there is so much misconception around what overturning Roe actually means, right? We just got out of the field with a survey that we did in conjunction with the Susan B. Anthony List. And what we found is that the majority of voters support upholding Roe. But then when you ask them, all right, your choice is now between a Republican who will ban abortion at 6 weeks when a fetal heartbeat is detected, or a Democrat who will keep abortion legal up until the moment of birth. They choose the Republican by a 2-to-1 margin almost, right? So like part of this is just, there's misconceptions. People actually think that, including like AP reporters, right? Like I've talked to a few AP reporters over the past few months in regard to this, and they didn't realize that this now goes back to the states, that it's not just an overall ban. And you know why that is? It's because every time the Supreme Court rules with the left, they give them these broad sweeping rulings, right? Like it would make, I mean, if you're just the average Joe who doesn't really know much about, you know, Supreme Court law and how the law works, and you hear they're going to overturn Roe, you're going to think it's just as widespread and as broad of a decision. as Roe was itself. But in reality, it's not that big. It's going to go back to the states. States are going to be able to determine when you can get an abortion. It's not going to be completely banned. So I think Dave Portnoy and the other Barstool conservatives who are saying stuff like this don't realize that it's going to be a state's issue, that most states are probably going to ban it at 15 weeks to start off, or when a fetal heartbeat is detected. I think when you actually tell voters, like, hey, abortion is going to be legal for the first 6 weeks and then illegal after that, I think they're probably with us. And I don't just think that. I know that because I've seen the polling on it. So I'm not worried about it because they just need to know more. And the bad thing for Democrats is that once Roe is overturned, Americans are going to see there's still abortion in this country, that you can still get one. And so I think that there's just going to be a lot of clarity once Roe is overturned.
I think that's really interesting perspective, although one important point is it depends on the ability to sort of cut through the spin of the establishment, of the corporate media, of the Democratic establishment, the political establishment, which has become very culturally radical on these issues, academia, all of that. You have to be able to cut through the spin to, you know, even like take Roe, for example, to tell people what the consequences would actually be, and to have these conversations about abortion. And you mentioned you talked to AP reporters, and that is so fascinating to me. First of all, it's fascinating to me that they know, like, they should be talking to you, but now that they know that they should be talking to you, I think that's fantastic, because you really are, like I said earlier, moving the needle. And I wonder if you could just talk to us a little bit about those conversations you have with AP reporters, legacy media reporters in general, who have become so secular, progressive, sort of elite, ideological, that they might think your worldview is hateful and bigoted, or, you know, against their human rights or whatever it is. How do those conversations go when you're talking to them about your work?
It's interesting because I get on the phone with a lot of these people and they're prepared to talk to like a really angry person who hates transgender people. And they're usually shocked when I tell them that I love transgender people probably more than the left does. I think that the bad guys are not trans people. I think that they are the ideologues. I think they're the people in the schools pushing this on kids. I think it's big pharma. I think it's the doctors who are making lots of money off of these surgeries that are irreparable, right? And that ultimately, I want to help transgender people. I think that there, throughout the course of American history, there have been a lot of medical fads that have caught on. We just saw it with COVID. I mean, I saw this video, this picture of someone hugging their elderly mother through like a plastic screen, right? Like, there are really bad medical fads that catch on because, guess what? Our elites, doesn't matter what sector of our country they're in, they make mistakes and they do bad things, even if they think they're good. And, you know, the transgender thing, I think, is a mixture of really bad people who want to destroy America, and they would define it as the white, heteronormative patriarchy, whatever. And then there are like the well-intentioned people who just want to support people, and they've read all this research from ideologues about how affirming a child in their gender identity at 3 years old is actually very healthy for them and keeps them from committing suicide. I have a different solution for transgender people. I think that they should conquer the gender dysphoria, right? And when I break it down to that, like, basically, there are two sides to the gender dysphoria problem. The left wants to embrace the gender dysphoria. They want to tell people, you know, you think that you're a different gender. Well, you're right, and we need to change your body. Well, that would be like handling anorexia by telling the person that they really are overweight and we need to give them liposuction. We don't do that, and there's a reason for that, because it would kill the person. And I think what we're seeing with transgender people is they're desisting, right? They're detransitioning. After years of trying to live as the other gender, they're realizing, wow, I chopped off my breasts and I'm still not a man. And I think that ultimately there's going to be a lot of malpractice lawsuits that hopefully end up bankrupting this industry because it's very corrupt. But that's just like a few recent things, right? Like, I'm not even getting into eugenics as a practice or lobotomies as a practice. Like, there have been a lot of really bad medical fads that caught on, some with good intentions, others with bad. But the medical community and medical experts can make mistakes. They are human. And, but once I break it down to like, I just feel really bad for these people. I want them to be able to live their fullest life. And I really do mean that, right? Like, I don't wake up in the morning hating transgender people. I actually wake up worried that they're going to create more, that these elites are going to create more transgender people, that they're going to confuse more little kids about their gender and get them on a lifetime supply of hormone treatments, a lifetime of mutilated bodies that they never actually feel comfortable in, right? And I don't know, like, they're usually shocked. They usually still write the hit piece, which fine. But, you know, and I also, one thing that I've been blown away by is when I'm on the phone with these reporters, they'll say stuff about the harm and the violence against transgender people. One person said, you know, what do you have to say about all this anti-transgender people? Don't you think it's going to lead to an increase in the epidemic of violence against trans people? And I said, well, hold on. According to the Human Rights Campaign, if you actually read that report, there's like 40 instances of violence against trans people in a whole year, right? Like, more people are killed in Chicago, like 100 times more people are killed in Chicago through gang violence each year. You know, but there's not really an epidemic of violence. And by the way, a lot of trans people, a lot of those situations of violence are actually among prostitutes, right? Like, they don't tell the whole picture. And I think that it's just important to stay calm, keep a smile on your face, even though this stuff's really depressing and heart-wrenching, but you just gotta stay calm and educate people, because that's what this country was founded on. It was founded in an optimism and the ability of everyday people to do the right thing, regardless of how hard it becomes. And so anyway, sorry, I mean, they're usually just shocked to know that I'm not like rabid and full of hate for these people, because I really am not. I love them.
So I definitely consider my incessant skepticism both a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing in journalism for sure, but as I've watched all of these MyPillow ads over the years, I have just been plagued by the question, are these as good as the commercials say they are? I've always wondered this, and when the fine folks over at MyPillow were kind enough to send me some of their products, I was really pleasantly surprised. These things are great, and right now they're having a BOGO extravaganza, so you can get buy one, get one free pricing on the MyPillow bed sheets as low as $59.98, the Elegance MyPillows as low as $49.98, and that six-piece towel sets. Those are my favorite. Those are included in the BOGO extravaganza. Also, the Roll and Go Anywhere My Pillows for $29.98 and so much more. Those six-piece towel sets are made with cotton grown here in the United States. Other towels feel good but don't absorb, or they absorb but they don't feel good. Every MyPillow towel is made from proprietary technology that makes them highly absorbent and soft to the touch. I can confirm that. It's absolutely true. Like I said, these are my favorites. They have no lotiony feel either. Every set comes with two bath towels, two hand towels, and two washcloths, so you got everything you need. They're available in a variety of colors and sizes, and they are machine washable and come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a one-year limited warranty. Those roll and go anywhere MyPillows. You can use them on your couch, your recliner, or in your car. They're versatile enough to take on vacation or really anywhere you go. They're also available in multiple colors and patterns and machine washable and dryable for all you parents. That's the most important part. They come with a 10-year warranty and a 60-day money-back guarantee as well. So as you can see, it's a buy one, get one extravaganza over at mypillow.com/federalist. Bed sheets and MyPillows are just the tip of the iceberg. Find the full list of BOGO offers by visiting mypillow.com/federalist or call 800-794-8429. Stock up with buy one, get one free savings today and get Mike's book free with any purchase. MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. MyPillow.com/Federalist. Yeah, I just like hearing you talk about these issues, because that's something Republicans have tried to communicate and message on for forever, but you really just do it better. And like I said, I think provide a model. And I wonder if there's something not politically but morally more attractive about social conservatism or cultural conservatism. Is it becoming more attractive as the ravages of secular liberalism become more apparent and more obvious for so many people? I mean, just thinking about there are traditions that we have when it comes to sex and gender and marriage and divorce and all of these things, child rearing. I guess I wonder if talking about those things from your perspective, even as it's gotten difficult culturally, but as the, because of those difficulties, because of those cultural difficulties, because of the sort of tragedies we're seeing unfold in different ways with different issues, has that made the work of pitching social cultural conservatism in a very secular world, has that made it any easier at all?
No, it's still tough, right? Think about it, like, if you're sick and you feel bad about yourself, it's tough sometimes to know what's going on, right? I had a college professor who was telling us a story about how he would get home from work every day and he thought he had cancer. He thought he had cancer because he felt nauseous. Every day at work, he would have migraines. And, you know, he ended up putting the piece together. He was just hungry, right? His wife would feed him and he'd feel a lot better. Well, he didn't have cancer. He was just hungry. And so I think that the problem we're dealing with is you have a lot of really unhappy people and they're blaming all the wrong people and things for their problems because they're looking outwardly. They're not looking inwardly. And that's a really tough battle to win. Because they basically have to get rid of their pride. They have to admit that things they're doing in their life, they're responsible for. And if you're unhappy, it's your fault. Not, I almost had a tweet I didn't tweet out the other day, but it was like, you know, anti-Semitism is so terrible because you're like blaming like Jews for all your problems. Like it's almost as, I mean, it's like worse than like blaming black people for all your problems or white people for all your problems. Like it's so bad. Like, it's not my fault that you're poor. It's not my fault that you're unhappy. It's not my fault that you have a bad life. People around you that you've associated with have made bad decisions, right? Mm-hmm. Or not made the best decisions. And I just think that if we looked inwardly and saw like Dave Portnoy, I mean, he's a successful man, but I don't know that he's happy. I mean, like if keeping a woman's right to like, or I'm sorry, not keeping a woman's right. If keeping doctors' rights to profit off of killing a mother's firstborn child is that important to you, like you can't really be happy, right? Like you have to, we just had our sixth baby, right? And I know that sounds weird to most people, but what's crazy is like when you hold this baby in your hand, they're a human being, right? Like they're not just a baby. They're going to go on and they're going to be someone's spouse someday. They're going to be someone's best friend. They could be someone's doctor, someone's teacher. No one's an island. You're going to go on and affect other people. And I think that abortion is so tragic because you're robbing the world of the joy that these kids are going to have. And like, I love Tim Scott's interrogation yesterday during that hearing. Like Janet Yellen, like, don't tell me that poor black women need to have abortions to do well. My mom was poor and black. And you can be poor and have a really happy life in this country. That's what's great about America. You don't have to be super rich. You don't have to be Jeff Bezos rich in order to be happy. A lot of people have been happy throughout humanity without having everything. And I don't know, this is getting really philosophical and really religious almost.
That's exactly what we want, Terry.
No, it's good. It's good.
Well, so this sort of necessarily goes in a religious, philosophical direction because I do think that a lot of secular libertarianism is built on this house of sand philosophically in a very kind of postmodern world where when you're pushed more and more to say, well, what truth, foundational truth is this based on? And as you push for more in the push past more and more of those layers, okay, well then what's the foundation of this and this? You realize you don't have all the answers.
Yeah. No, and the thing is like, you're seeing this now with the Roe debate, right? Keep your rosaries off my ovaries. Like what does separation of church and state mean? Right? Like you really want people to, how do you separate how you vote and what you believe to be true? I mean, isn't that what religion ultimately is? Is it's like your most foundational and basic belief of what the truth of the universe is? How do you separate out what you believe to be true when it comes to God and natural rights and natural law versus, I just don't know how you separate that, right? Like ultimately, like it would be one thing if, you know, abortion was just a religious belief, but like, why do we have gay marriage then? Right? Like, isn't isn't the LGBT movement kind of a religion in a way? I mean, yeah, they don't believe in God, or, you know, it's not pertaining to God or the some mythical, or not mythical, but mystical thing. It's a belief about what's true and what's good. And ultimately, that's what religion comes down to. And so it's impossible, really, to separate religion from the law. Now, it's one thing to, like, mandate that people go to Catholic Mass on Sunday, or to go to church at all on Sunday. That's a totally different thing. But I don't know. Like, I just don't get this whole, like, you can't regulate abortion because it's religious. Like, it's not religious. You can be against abortion and be an atheist. You can be against abortion and be Hindu. You can be against abortion and be Buddhist. It has nothing to do with your religion in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah. I think that's a very telling statement on how far we've come, that there's sort of idea that abortion necessarily is being litigated in the religious arena when this is so far from the truth. And the way that pro-life people even talk about it now is there's so much more science and medical information about embryology that we know. But Terry, we were talking recently, and I referenced this earlier about marriage, which is something absolutely nobody wants to talk about, because conservatives were just bludgeoned for years by the establishment, and eventually Obergefell was, as you say, culture's downstream of politics, the nail in the coffin in terms of any conservative efforts to push back. And I'm not even going to talk about legality right now, but the morality of marriage, because the legal question is a different one that I think a lot of people have reasonable disagreements on. Nobody wants to talk about marriage. I have very little problem talking about marriage, even though I know it's fraught and can get to a very uncomfortable topic, in the same sense that you were sort of talking about transgenderism earlier. It's makes me sort of sad to think about the cultural denigration of marriage as an institution. And I don't mean this just in the context of same-sex couples. I just mean this in general, marriage in general. We now have such a secular idea of what marriage is. So as somebody looking back at how love is love, really, that facile logic really won the argument and then was reflected in the facile logic of the Obergefell opinion. Looking back, like, what lessons do you think can be learned from how that love is love type logic won this argument in the court of public opinion and in the literal court, and then which really swayed public opinion? And then how do you have this conversation now? I mean, how do you message a counter argument in the culture of the culture of 2022?
Well, I think at a minimum, or, you know, at a most basic level, family is critical to the survival of a species, right? Like, a man and a woman are the only two things that can actually create a baby. You always need a man and a woman to be involved in the creation of a new human life. And if we don't reproduce, humanity is going to go extinct. And, you know, this question came up on a radio show around CPAC, you know, define family. Well, it's easy. It's like, how would I explain, or if I went into a small African village or a small South American village or a small Asian village, and I asked them what a family would be, they would say, oh, that's a mom and a dad with a baby, at least, right? Like, that's what a family is. And I think in America, we're too polite and we're too kind in a lot of ways, in that we will avoid conflict to make the other person feel comfortable. And there's something good about that, right? Like, we don't want to be rabid. We don't want to be hateful. We want people to feel comfortable regardless of their feelings or their thoughts. Like, we want people to feel a part of this country. It's part of being an American. But ultimately, words have definitions, right? And there is a natural law to things. And until two men can create a baby or two women can create a baby, we're always going to have family as between a man and a woman. It's just how God created us. And, you know, I don't tell this story often because it hits close to home, but there is, I have a friend who in college, I started identifying as a lesbian, and she ended up getting married, they got a sperm donor essentially, and they had a baby. Well, that created division and conflict in the marriage. And what happened was, the other spouse that didn't carry the baby said, you know, well, that's not really my baby. I didn't really do anything. I didn't carry the baby. It doesn't have my genetic material. That's your baby. And so they tried to solve that problem in an even more insane way. and they took an egg from the other spouse and had the other spouse carry the baby to term. Well, then after they had two babies, one from the other mom, they would argue over whose baby was better or whose was cuter or, you know, whatever. And when I found out about that, I was just like, it made me appreciate my own marriage, right? Like the unity that my wife and I have. Like, we can jokingly say like, oh, he's, you know, Bobby X just like you, you know, he's such a little jerk. But you know, he's still 50% Katie, right? Like, you know, so, you know, they might, your kids might look like you and act like the spouse. Like, I can't actually say that one of our kids is mine and one of the kids is the other. And I think that ultimately gay marriage is an inherently divisive institution. The thing that holds a marriage and a family together is that child. And I think it's really important that, I mean, for the healthiest families, there's an equal relationship to the child. And that's not to say that, like, you know, if you adopt a baby, that that's wrong. That's actually like one of the most charitable and best things you could possibly do for someone. And it's not even to say that like a mixed marriage is bad. Like, I'm just saying that like, there is complete unity when a man marries a woman and they have a baby together. There's no like, oh, that's your kid, that's my kid. And there are a lot of families that are truly built on love that can have mixed marriages, that can have adoptions. I mean, I haven't met a family yet that fights over which kids, but like when you have these gay unions and you're literally buying and selling babies, I think it's a naturally and inherently harmful and inherently divisive union. It's really just being done in a lot of ways for like a narcissistic purpose.
It's sad to, it makes me sad to think about how taboo it is to have these conversations, because if you want to get to a better place in either direction on this question, I mean, just being able to actually debate and talk about it is so important, but we're beyond that at this point. And except for you, Terry. but I want to ask, I saved the biggest question for last. And because I've used the word big intentionally, I'll say you just released a report on big tech. And I went to a panel that the Conservative Partnership Institute hosted for you guys at APP when you launched the report. And our friends Bedford and Rachel Bovard were there. And Bedford did not drink until he was done moderating his panel, which was a huge accomplishment. But Terry, the report is great. It's really interesting. It sheds light on censorship and all of the sort of downstream problems that come with that on big tech. And I want to ask you in general how corporate America and big business have played a role in fomenting a lot of the cultural problems you talk about all of the time.
Well, I think it's important to distinguish between the, you know, the pre-2010 era, where I would say that there were a lot of big businesses, but they identified primarily as American companies and their priority was America, versus post-2010, where you saw the rise of the global corporation that was actually more concerned and more loyal to their foreign partners than America. Even though they're domiciled in America, they benefit from all the handouts in the American corporate tax code, they still have a greater allegiance to companies like, or countries like China, right? Because of the market share, which, by the way, is another argument for family formation and having more kids and fixing the coming demographic crisis. There's a lot of power when it comes to people, and markets are driven by people. Because of that shift to the global corporation that's located in America, these corporations they have no concern about the American family. They have no concern about Americanism and what it means to be an American, or preserving our American heritage and free elections and free, you know, free speech and the rights that we've established here in America. They care much more about bringing in money from any source possible, and they're willing to break any American morals or rules to get that. The craziest thing for me is the online censorship from big tech, right? Like, and I think that I still don't think we appreciate how big of a deal it is for a U.S. domiciled company like Twitter to censor the president of the United States and to ban him from their platforms. Your government should not like run your entire life. But your government should be powerful. It should be more powerful than the corporations in the country. And that was a real signal that there's been a shift in the power dynamics. American global corporations, at least now until Republicans rein them in, are technically more powerful than the president of the United States, which is it's a first in American history. The companies have always been subject to the laws and to those that govern them in this country. And it's very, very odd that they have absolutely no fear of reprisal from our government. And it's almost like there's collusion or coordination between these big corporations and the woke activists that are within our own federal government now. It's very concerning.
And Terry, my iPad is about to die at any second, but I did want to tell you, I really see you as like the MVP, the most valuable player in the conservative movement, because nobody really had the foresight or the deftness to get in the spaces that you've gotten into with APP. So seriously, it's a pleasure to have you on Federalist Radio Hour, as always. And I mean that really sincerely. I really see you as the MVP.
No, thanks so much, Emily. I'll come on anytime. The next time I want to have a beer or two.
Well, of course. Yeah, then we can drag Bedford into the mix and we'll generously share with him some of the beers. We'll just do a six pack. That makes sense. We can divide it evenly, two, two, and two. Terry Schilling of the American Principles Project, always a pleasure to have you on Federalist Radio Hour. I am Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at The Federalist. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.
The faint voice of reason, and then it faded away.